This evening, we're continuing our overview of the Old Testament book titled 2 Samuel. But before we examine the events that are found here in 2 Samuel 15, I should take a moment to put our text back into its context. It'll help you to remember that David's third son, Absalom, he had murdered his half-brother Amnon, and the reason for this act of manslaughter was simply revenge. Remember, Amnon was guilty of raping Absalom's sister, Tamar, and rather than letting him get away with it, Absalom decided to take judicial matters into his own hands. And so he murdered his half-brother, Amnon. And then in order to escape the punishment that he actually deserved, Absalom fled from Israel and he spent 2 years in Geshur. But then came the day when David was duped into allowing Absalom to return without punishment. And while you would think that he would have been a grateful son, you would think that he would be grateful for the mercy that he was shown. You think he would be grateful for the grace that his father and his king had shown him. Absalom wasn't grateful at all, but instead he was bitter. He was bitter about the lack of justice that his father failed to provide. He was bitter that his father had failed to provide justice for his sister Tamar. It's for this reason that Absalom decided to revolt against the rule and the reign of his father David. And he did this by convincing his kinsmen, the rest of Israel, to overthrow the throne of King David. Now, with all of this in mind, let's turn our attention to the events that unfold here in 2 Samuel chapter 15. If you would look with me, beginning there at verse 1, here we read, "After this it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him." Now, I want to stop right here because here in the opening verse of this chapter, we find Absalom, he's now surrounding himself with a security detail. Well, it's possible that he was just wanting to present the appearance of being a politically important person. It's my guess that Absalom was actually suffering from crippling paranoia. As I just pointed out, he was a man who had taken judicial matters into his own hands. He felt like his father had failed to provide justice for his sister, and that is true. But rather than allowing the law to run its course, rather than demanding true justice from the judges of Israel, Absalom decided to murder his half-brother. And so I imagine that he was living with a constant concern that those who live by the sword end up dying by the sword. I'm guessing that he had a crippling fear that the avenger of blood was going to come a calling on him. Well, regardless of the reason for his personal security detail, what we do know is that Absalom started calling his father's leadership into question. And with this in mind, if you would look with me, the beginning at verse 2. Here we learn that Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice." And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now, in order to grasp Absalom's plan here, it'll help you to know that the wisest elders of Israel would typically sit at the gates of their city. And then whenever the people of that city had a legal issue which needed some level of mediation, the people would simply seek justice from the elders of Israel who were seated at the gate. And as you might imagine, there were times when the legal matter was too difficult for the elders to decide, or maybe there was some disagreement amongst the elders there at the gate. And it was at that point in time when those people would then be sent to Jerusalem so that the king could make a final decision concerning their case. And knowing that this was the way that things worked, well, Absalom decided that he would rise up early in the morning and go stand on the road that led to the gate of Jerusalem, where the judges of Jerusalem would sit and the elders of Israel would sit. And there they would gain access to the king of Israel. It was there where Absalom would call the authority of his father into question. And he would do this by telling the people who were seeking justice that his father was just too busy to help them, and he had failed to delegate someone who could actually accomplish the task. And so he's saying, I'm your man. I'm the guy that can accomplish this for you. Well, then after presenting the people of Israel with this distorted accusation about his father David, Absalom would go on to present himself as the solution to all their problems, and he would embrace them and kiss them and love on them and just make them feel like they've been heard and accepted. And basically, Absalom was attempting to convince the people of Israel that he was the one who could truly restore justice to the land of Israel. I'm guessing that he truly believed that he would do a better job than his father. Clearly, this was nothing more than a delusion of grandeur, which oftentimes affects those who are very self-centered. And that's true of Absalom here. He's so self-centered that he just thinks that his father was a complete failure and he would do a way better job. And yet, I would argue that Absalom was suffering from self-delusion. In order to prove my point, I should first remind you that Absalom was already guilty of perverting justice. He had already proven that he doesn't really grasp biblical justice. And we see this in the fact that he decided that his half-brother Amnon deserved to die after raping his sister. Now, there is no doubt that this act of rape was horrific. It's horrible. But does it deserve capital punishment? And biblically, the answer is no. Amnon deserved to be punished according to the law, but capital punishment was way too extreme for the crime. So I would argue that Absalom's decision to carry out capital punishment on his half-brother Amnon, it's not based in true justice, but rather it's based in his desire for revenge. Well, not only did Absalom fail to provide true justice in the case of his sister's rape, but he also sought to escape the justice that he himself deserved after murdering Amnon. So he demands justice in the case of Amnon, but wants to avoid justice in his own case. And so that's why he fled and left the land of Israel, was to avoid receiving the justice that he deserved. Think about it. Absalom was a man who deserved capital punishment because of his crime of manslaughter. However, rather than handing himself over and standing for biblical justice, he instead surrounded himself here with bodyguards in order to avoid capital punishment. Clearly, this is not a man who understands biblical justice. Finally, we should notice again the lie that Absalom was presenting there in verse 4. Notice again there he declares, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone, not some people, but everyone who has any suit, not some suits, but all the suits or causes would come to me, then I would give him justice." Wow. That's a huge claim. One that no judge could really follow up on except for the one true judge, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. But as we consider this promise of justice for everyone, I can't help but to wonder what he would do on the day when Amnon's mother showed up and demanded justice for the murder of her son. How would he, how would he officiate that case? Because in order to provide true justice for Amnon's mother, he would have to hand himself over for capital punishment. You better believe he wasn't about to do that. And so there's no way for him to make good on this promise to provide everyone who has any suit true justice. Well, sadly, the people of Israel began to embrace Absalom because he was embracing them. He was embracing them and kissing them and making them feel loved. And so they embraced him. He stole their hearts. As a matter of fact, look with me again there at the end of verse 6. There we learn that Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. That word stole in this context, it speaks of deception, which is accomplished in secret. So we see then that Absalom was secretly deceiving the people of Israel so that they might help him with his plans. And his plans? Well, his plans were to overthrow his father's throne. This sort of reminds me of the warning that the Apostle Peter presented in 2 Peter chapter 2. It's there where he warns the church about the false teachers who will secretly bring in destructive heresy. So they don't come in, just preaching their heresy. No, they secretly bring in destructive heresies. They want to pull people off to the side and have those one-on-ones and make them feel all warm and loved and embraced. And then they begin to slowly, secretly bring in those destructive heresies. Christian, listen, the church is actually filled with Absaloms. The church is filled with Absaloms who are happy to tell us whatever we want to hear just so that we can join up with them so that they can steal our hearts. It's sad to say that there are many backslidden believers who are following after these sorts of false teachers, and the reason why is because they love to hear the beautiful lies of the Absaloms of the world. What's even worse is that there are leaders in the church who actually have invited these false teachers in just because of their own lack of discernment. And with this in mind, let's consider the example of this that David sets. If you would look with me beginning at verse 7, here we read, "Now it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron." Here in these verses, we find Absalom, and it says here that it came to pass after 40 years, and yet I would just point out that it is a bit of a Bible difficulty, but I believe what this is saying is that this happened at the time of Absalom's 40th birthday. I believe he was 40 years old when he began this secret insurrection, and when he was taking this insurrection to the next level. And while he was presenting himself here as being this submissive servant who simply wanted to go to Hebron and honor the Lord and honor the vows that he had made, Absalom was actually devising a way to dethrone David. And it's sad to say that all of this was happening not only right under David's nose, but by his authority. David was the one who said, "Yeah, sure, go to Hebron. Go in peace. Go with my blessing. Go with my approval." Not only that, I'll remind you that David, he's the one who allowed Absalom to return without facing the biblical justice that he deserved. And it would have been one thing if Absalom would have come back saying, I blew it, I'm completely guilty, and threw himself at the mercy of the court. And it'd be one thing if he was a repentant man. And then to see David turn around and say, "Okay, we forgive you," But that's not the way it went. He was not a repentant man. And yet, he was given forgiveness. That being the case, Absalom's insurrection was actually enabled by the king of Israel. David was the leader who was enabling his son to create this insurrection right under his very nose. And in similar fashion, there are many leaders in the church today who are enabling false teachers to deceive the masses by endorsing their ministries and by selling their books. I can't even tell you how many times I've gone into Christian bookstores, whether inside a church or outside, and seen teachers that I know are not Christian. Teachers that I know are heretics, and yet there's their book on the shelf. And it's sad to say that too many Christians come along, that pastor endorses that teacher, and so he must be all right. Don't think for one minute that just because the book is being sold in a Christian bookstore, or because the CD is on the shelf of the local Christian bookstore, or because the band played at, some popular church in town, that, they must be Christian then. Listen, there's a lot of pastors that have zero discernment when it comes to these sorts of issues. And much like David, they're allowing these false teachers to just breed their insurrections against Christ within the context of the church. It's for this very reason that Paul warned Pastor Titus about the deceivers who were subverting whole households. And so if you think that I'm just kind of, much too paranoid about nothing, Paul told Titus that these deceivers were coming along and subverting whole households there in the first century. Paul tells Titus that they're teaching things that they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. And then rather than allowing Titus to endorse those ministries of those false teachers, Paul declared their mouths must be stopped. That's what Paul says. Their mouths must be stopped. Not only that, but he encourages Titus to rebuke them sharply so that they might be sound in the faith. Based on this, I would insist that every good pastor should be ready to rebuke false teachers who are leading people astray with false doctrines. Because listen, if we don't, if the leaders of the church don't, then we're simply just allowing the Absaloms of this world to lead the church astray with doctrines of demons. Sadly, David here is allowing his son to lead the people of Israel astray. He's allowing Absalom to lead the people of Israel into this act of insurrection. And with this in mind, look with me there beginning at verse 10. Here we learn that Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron." And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. Here in these verses, we find Absalom, he's establishing his insurrection from the city of Hebron. And in order to understand why he went to Hebron, I would guess that this is due to the fact that Hebron was actually the place where the prophet Samuel anointed King David. Not only that, but this was also where he first began to reign over Judah. Remember, David reigned in Hebron for 7 years before becoming king over all of the tribes and all of the land. Based on this, it's possible that Absalom saw Hebron as a great place to set up his own headquarters. And it was there in Hebron where his conspiracy to claim the king's crown, well, it grew stronger there. And we should notice that he did this by sending out heralds throughout all of the land to all the different cities. And these heralds were sent to deceive the people into believing that he had already ascended to the throne there in Hebron. And you know what's sad to say? That the people there in Israel were quick to believe this rumor. Just because someone stood up and said, "Oh, Absalom's reigning in Hebron," that the people in these cities were like, "Oh, it's the truth then. Someone said it. I saw it on the internet. It's got to be true." They didn't spend any time examining the evidence of this statement. It was just believed. This is precisely why Absalom invited these 200 men who were innocent. They didn't know anything about this. He invited them so that they would take the testimony of this back to David. As a matter of fact, look with me there beginning at verse 13. Here we learn that a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." So David said to all of his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said to the king, "We are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands." Then the king went out with all his household after him. But the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep the house. And then the king went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts. Then all his servants passed before him, and all the Cherethites and the Pelethites and the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath, passed before the king. Now here in these verses we find David, he's responding now to the rumor that he had received from this unnamed messenger, more than likely one of those 200 men that Absalom brought along. But rather than investigating the truth of the claims that he had received, David immediately reacts by encouraging his servants to flee with him so that they could escape from the anger of Absalom. As we consider his rapid response to this rumor, we must not fail to recognize that it's always better to investigate the reports that we receive before reacting. Oh, it's the emotional drive for us to react first and investigate later, but that's wrong. We should investigate first before we react. One reason why is due to the fact that there are many people who, like that unnamed messenger, they're just reporting what they heard, and yet what they heard was incorrect. That unnamed messenger was innocently repeating a rumor without actually making sure that the rumor was actually true. And we know many people like this. They innocently repeat a rumor thinking that it's the truth, but they themselves never actually investigate it. They're just telling you what they heard. Christian, listen, just because you trust the person who's providing you with the information doesn't automatically prove that that person has the facts straight. You might trust that person, but that doesn't mean that person's trustworthy. You might trust that person, but that doesn't mean that they receive information from someone who's trustworthy. When you start receiving third, fourth-hand information, I mean, who knows what happened along the way? And so if you just instantly react, you might be reacting to something that's not even true, though the person who tells you thinks that it's true. Listen, people are quite often confused about what they heard. And not only that, but it's also possible that they've received that information, from a source that they couldn't really trust. That being the case, we would all do well to go and check the facts before we run out and repeat the reports that we've received. God forbid that the church would be known for spreading rumors and false news. In order to understand why this is so important, let's continue to consider the way in which this information affected those who were following King David. And so if you would look with me there, we'll pick up our study at verse 19. Here we learn that the king said to Ittai, the Gittite, "Why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. In fact, you came only yesterday. Should I make you wander up and down with us today, since I go, I know not where? Return and take your brother back. Mercy and truth be with you." But Ittai answered the king and said, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also your servant will be." So David said to Ittai, "Go and cross over." Then Ittai the Gittite and all his men and all the little ones who were with him crossed over. And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over toward the way of the wilderness. Now here in these verses, we find the servants of David, they're fleeing for their lives. Even this guy who had just arrived the day before, they're all fleeing for their lives because they've believed this rumor that Absalom truly is reigning in Hebron. And so they begin to make their way out of Jerusalem over the brook Kidron, and they're making their way to the wilderness. They're headed to the Jordan River, and they're going to cross over. Now, it's true that Absalom was, in fact, organizing an army against David. That part is true. And yet it's also true that David's decision to lead his family and his friends out of Israel was simply based on a report that came from a friend who had been deceived into thinking that Absalom's army was much larger than it actually was. And David's departure enabled Absalom to actually bolster his army even more. That wouldn't have been the case if David would have said, "Oh no, we're going to stay and fight." And yet David, I think, wanted to protect his family and avoid a civil war. And so he's simply making his way out of Israel. I would argue, though, that it would have been more prudent for David to stop, to avoid the reaction and to simply check the facts first. Is Absalom truly reigning in Hebron? He should have checked it out first. He should have sent spies. He should have investigated, but he didn't. Instead, he rushed to make this rash decision to run away. And as a result, the country wept with a loud voice as they left their homes. We see then how David's decision ends up impacting all of these people. In light of this, it's important for every Christian to realize that the devil and his demons are constantly trying to trick us into believing that they have way more power than they actually have. I'll just go, watch the Hollywood horror movies, and you'll see this weird empowering of demons, that I don't think is actually true. Now, I'm not suggesting that demons are weak. I mean, they're fallen angels, and angels are definitely powerful, more powerful than us. And yet, Christ in us is greater than he who's in the world, right? I'll remind you that Jesus has given authority to Christians over demons. And so if you allow yourself to be filled with fear because of all these Hollywood movies that want to convince us that these demons are much more powerful over our lives than they actually are, you know, have fun with that, but I'll choose to believe what the Bible says. The devil and his demons want to trick you into thinking that, you know, Satan rules in Hebron. Run away. And if you're a Christian who is constantly fleeing from the enemy, I would simply just remind you of what John wrote in 1 John 4, verse 4. There he declares, "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." If Christ is dwelling in your heart, and Christ is the one who created those angels who fell, then we don't need to worry about demons. And we don't need to run away when we hear that Satan is ruling in Hebron. We don't have to worry about it, because greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. Now, it's possible that you've allowed the lies of the enemy to lead you into the wilderness, and maybe you've been running away and you don't know what to do. And if so, I would encourage you to consider what David did next. And if you would look with me, beginning at verse 24, here we read, "There was Zadok also, and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. Then the king said to Zadok, 'Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. But if he says thus, I have no delight in you, here I am, let him do to me as seems good to him.'" Here in these verses, we find David, he's beginning to regain his composure after reacting to the rumor. And I think now that they're on the move, he's beginning to realize that, you know what, Absalom isn't the one in control here. Because he wasn't. Oh, Absalom thought he was. But he wasn't. The Lord is the sovereign king of heaven and earth, and though Absalom convinced David to leave the throne of Israel, the God of heaven is still on his throne. And no one can dethrone the Lord. It's just not going to happen. The Lord is the sovereign king of heaven and earth, and what this means then is that he's the one ultimately in control. He's the one who is large and in charge. He's the one who has everything under his control. And while it doesn't seem like that a lot of times, it's true. He's on the throne. We no longer need to fear the enemy, because remember, greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. Paul confirms this for us in his second letter to Pastor Timothy. There he declares, "God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." I love that. And in Romans 8, Paul elaborated on this truth by assuring his Roman readers that we did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but we received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, "Abba, Father." If you're filled with fear tonight and you're running to the wilderness because the enemy's got you all afraid, I would just say, if you're a Christian, then you need to cry out, "Abba, Father." You need to cry out to God. He's the one on the throne, and he's the one that can take care of business for you. If your heart is filled with fear because you're certain that the enemy is trying to destroy your life, let me assure you, he is trying to destroy your life. Don't wonder about it. I'm here to tell you that's the case. He's seeking those that he can devour. And yet, greater is he who is in the Christian than he who is in the world. We haven't been given a spirit of fear, but a spirit of adoption. And through that spirit of adoption, we cry out to God the Father and say, "You're our Father. You're our Daddy. Take care of us." And he does. The born-again believer doesn't need to run. We don't need to flee from the enemy. No, instead, we should simply cry out to the Father. And as we do, we just need to have that heart that rests in assurance that God is going to do with us whatever seems good to him. That's the reality of it. The Father will do with us whatever seems good to him. And whatever seems good to him is the best thing for us. Furthermore, I would also encourage you to seek the insights of the spiritual leaders that the Lord has raised up here within your church. And in order to explain what I'm saying here, if you would look with me beginning at verse 27, Here we read, "The king also said to Zadok the priest, 'Are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me.' Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there." Now, here in these verses, we find David, he's asking Zadok the priest to return so that he might provide him with intel from on high. And in order to explain what I mean, we should notice again there in verse 27, there David asks, "Are you not a seer?" Or in other words, he's saying, "Are you not a prophet?" Prophets were known as seers at this point in time. And so he's asking, "Are you not a prophet? Do you not have the gift of prophecy? Can you not receive prophetic revelation from the Lord?" And then after asking this question, it's interesting that in the Hebrew here, we find David taking the same Hebrew word, which is translated seer, back in verse 27, and he uses that Hebrew word to present Zadok with the command to see in verse 28. He's saying, "Hey, aren't you a seer? Well, then see." I love it. David's basically saying, if you're really a seer, then go back to Jerusalem and seek the prophetic word of the Lord in regard to the revolt of Absalom. David then tells him, "I'm going to go wait in the plains of the wilderness until you see something. So you see and then report to me. I'm going to be there in the wilderness waiting for your report." From this we see that David was leaning on the high priest of Israel, who was a prophet, to provide him with spiritual insight into this revolt. And not only did David seek instruction from the priest, but he also spent time praying to the Lord. And with this in mind, look with me beginning at verse 30. Here we learn that David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up. And he had his head covered and went barefoot. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up, weeping as they went up. Then someone told David, saying, "Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." And David said, "O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Now, here in these verses, we find David, he's grieving over the fact that his former friend, and we learned earlier in this chapter that he was a counselor of David, this man named Ahithophel was now helping Absalom. And knowing that Ahithophel was a man who had provided him with wise counsel before, well, David knew that this could be trouble for him. And so he took the time to pray. He sought the Lord in prayer. And in this prayer, he asked the Lord to confuse the mind of Ahithophel so that the counsel that he gave to Absalom was nothing more than foolishness. I like that. He's praying that the Lord would confuse the words in the mind of Ahithophel. Now, this prayer is not a bad prayer. If I'm being completely honest tonight, I have to say that I've prayed some of these prayers before. Lord, just confuse the mind of that person that's trying to do our church harm. Confuse the mind of that person who's attempting to spread false, accusations and rumors. I have prayed those prayers against those who seek to harm me in this fellowship. At the same time, though, I believe that we would do better to spend more time asking God to give us the wisdom that we need. You know, it's one thing to say, "Lord, confuse their counsel," but it's even better for us to say, "God, give us counsel, give us wisdom, help us to know what to do with our life and how to make good decisions that are in line with His will." And I think that God did give David wisdom in how to deal with this. And with this in mind, I want to consider the next decision that David makes, which was sure to sabotage the sedition of Absalom. If you would look with me beginning at verse 32, here we read, "It happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshiped God, there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. David said to him, 'If you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant, then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And do you not have Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, with you there? Therefore it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall tell to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. Indeed they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything you hear.' So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem." Now here in the final verses of the chapter, we find David, he's worshiping God. And I love to see that. He's worshiping God. And though he finds himself on the run, though he finds himself, you know, in dire straits, he still has the mind to pray and to worship. And as he's worshiping God, here comes his friend Hushai. And Hushai, he sets out to faithfully follow his good friend David into the wilderness. But David asks him to stay. He asks him to return to Jerusalem with Zadok and Abiathar. The reason for this request was because David wanted Hushai to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And I believe that this was a decision which was based on wisdom that the Lord had given him as he was worshiping. At the same time, though, David's request was placing his friend Hushai in a very tough situation. And the reason why is because he's basically sending his friend back into the lion's den where he was being sent to overthrow or overcome the counsel of Ahithophel. And knowing that this was a real tough request, David directed Hushai to remain in fellowship with Zadok the high priest. And I love that counsel. He's saying, you're going to go as a sheep into this den of wolves, so don't lose touch with the high priest. And it's great counsel. And as we consider this counsel, I can't help but to consider the prayer that Jesus prayed. It's called the high priestly prayer, and it's found in John chapter 17. If you would, let's turn to John chapter 17. And as you make your way to the 17th chapter of John's gospel account, I want to point out that there are many Christians who find themselves in the world. They find themselves in a secular job. They find themselves surrounded by unbelievers. They find themselves sheep amongst wolves. And yet they don't stay connected with the high priest, who is Jesus Christ. Next thing you know, they're sheep who are simply living with wolves rather than being the evangelist and the light in the dark place that they've been called to become. If that sounds like something that you're struggling with, I must insist that the Christian has been called to be in the world, but not of the world. We haven't been called to go and fellowship with the world. We've been called to lead them to Christ while we fellowship with the church. I like the way that the Lord puts it here in his high priestly prayer. If you would look with me there at John chapter 17. We'll begin reading at verse 14 because here Jesus is praying to the Father and he declares, I have given them your word and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself that they also may be sanctified by the truth. Christian, listen, much like David, the Lord has sent us into the world. The Lord is calling us to go into the workplace, and regardless of whether you're a teacher or a tax collector or a traffic cop or whatever the case may be, you're there to be a missionary. You're there to be light in the darkness, and you're living as a sheep amongst wolves. You're a Hushai amongst Absaloms. And it's for this reason that David tells Hushai, stay connected with the high priest. And so Jesus also is saying, stay connected with the high priest. Jesus is our high priest. We must remain connected to him in order to be in the world, but not of the world. The Lord is calling us to serve him here in this world, and yet we're surrounded by the enemy. And it's so easy for us to be filled with fear and find ourselves fleeing for the wilderness. And yet, if we would just simply stay connected with the high priest, if we would simply stay connected to Jesus Christ and walk by faith with him, well, then we can continue to serve our Savior while working in the camp of Absalom. Therefore, I encourage you this evening, stay connected with the Lord Jesus Christ, both through prayer, through devotional, time with the Lord in his word, and then also through fellowship with the church. It's crucial for every Christian to stay connected with our high priest Jesus, and as we do, he sanctifies us by his truth. As we remain connected with him, he sanctifies us and enables us to walk in his eternal victory, even as we serve him in the camp of Absalom. Let's pray.